It is good for us to be here. Let us build three dwellings, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah. He babbles, dumbstruck. His eyes are heavy with sleep and his body is heavier. He was tired, our Peter, and he was blinded. Here stood his teacher, dazzling white in this inexplicable light, speaking with the two most important men in the history of his people. He saw them turn, and perhaps Moses lifted a hand to Jesus, and Peter knew that they were turning to leave. He blurts it out, leaning forward, top heavy and uncontrolled. He nearly topples down the mountain after them. Let us build three dwellings. He was acting wildly, but that was how he was, Simon Peter. He spoke before he thought. Today, we are celebrating the Feast of the Transfiguration. This event situates Jesus in the salvation history of his people. In Luke's gospel, it marks the beginning of his journey toward Jerusalem, the moment when his purpose becomes clear, almost as if now he knows what will happen to him and what that will mean. It begins with this strange encounter on a holy mountain, where he is enthroned in light, speaking in hushed convocation with the great lawgiver and the great prophet. His face is changed just like Moses's once was. Now to us, this might seem like one of the weirder stories in the New Testament, ghosts and blinding light and voices from heaven. But for Peter, James, and John, this has a clear and distinct meaning. Moses, leader of the Exodus from Egypt, is discussing Jesus' own departure with him. And the word translated here as departure is actually Exodus in Greek. Early Christians came to see Jesus' act of death and resurrection as a second Exodus, one in which he brought all of the souls out of hell. In dying, descending to the dead, and freeing the souls trapped there, Jesus was doing for everyone what Moses did for the living Israelites in their ancestral past. This event was embraced by the early church as the harrowing of hell. And you can find powerful paintings depicting Jesus leading all of the souls out of the underworld as a part of his act of resurrection. Now, Elijah is the prophet who never died. He is the one who was taken up to heaven in a whirlwind. To this day, a seat is left open for Elijah at the celebration of Passover, and he is ceremonially invited in. Elijah is, among many other things, believed to signal the coming of the Messiah. So for Peter, James, and John, this is it. Peter just called Jesus the Messiah a few verses before, and now Elijah is here. He has arrived. This moment is a testament to Peter, James, and John, and to all the early Christians who knew these stories and scriptures, that Jesus was a continuation of their God's work of salvation in the world. To us, this story remains a reminder that Jesus' identity and acts were not in a vacuum, but that they came out of a long history of God's devotion and love to the Jewish people, people who still live out their covenant today. But there's another reason why I love this story, and that's because of Peter. Simon Peter is one of the more cohesive characters in the New Testament, and he has a certain kind of attitude and identity. We actually see his character change and transform between Gospel and the Book of Acts and the Epistles. And in the Gospels, we get this portrait of an eager and hungry young man, maybe 20 or so. He's itching for something bigger, hungry for something else, some other meaning to this life. He speaks before he thinks. His eyes are maybe a little too wide, his pace maybe a little too quick, his voice just a little too loud. Maybe everyone he knows walks cautiously around him because they're not quite sure what he wants from this life, or from them. And they feel that this yearning is dangerous to their own fragile contentment. Peter works as a fisherman, day in and day out, going out on his boat, enormous hands hauling in rough rope nets. Fishermen are known to be gruff and troublesome, illiterate, fishing all night, possibly drinking all day, and the catch is always average unless it is less than average. And the fish go into the market, and then he goes out, and he does it again and again and again. The powerless rhythm of this good-for-nothing life must be deafening and destructive to this man with such exuberance and such an eager heart. And then comes this Jesus. And Simon, suddenly awake to what he's been desperate for, gets up and he goes and he just takes off after this Jesus. He leaves behind everything, the wife and the boats. And this is where I realize that I'm a little annoyed with Peter for his irresponsibility. But that is the infuriating beauty of it. Peter is so obviously imperfect, so obviously human, and so obviously unprepared for God's glory, just like we are, just like the whole church is. It is his yearning that makes him worthy, his belligerent belief in something more that makes him an apostle. Not his perfection, not his impeccable moral character, his ludicrous and irresponsible faith. That same faith that makes him blurt ridiculous things in inopportune moments. And so here they are on the mountain. Peter awestruck at his teacher enshrined in light with Moses and Elijah. He's sure that this is it. This is the moment that they have all been waiting for. God's glory is shining through and breaking in, and then he sees those two men turn away from Jesus. And he yells, "Wait! It is good for us to be here. Let us build three dwellings. Let us stay. Let us be here in this moment, in this glory. Please don't leave me." How often have we done the same? Standing before some impossible glory, some perfect moment of happiness, some moment when God's light and God's power are so visible all around, how often have we stood before that moment and desired only to keep it, to cling to it, to build a dwelling around it and tame it? There is a reason why Jesus chose Peter to build the church. We aren't so much different from him. We are also just fishermen, or we also speak before we think, or we are also just a little bit too sure of ourselves, or we will also deny him when danger is near. But perhaps we are also hungry for God, yearning for something more, clinging wildly to a hope that cannot be described, that perhaps this world is meant to be another way than it currently is, that perhaps there is a new promise lingering and ready to be made known, that perhaps there is a resurrection, a transformation, a reconciliation present in each next step that we take. In this moment on the mountain, Peter has no idea what's going to happen next. He stands transfixed by the glory, but he has no idea what God will do in the months, years, centuries to come. He has no idea what God will make out of him. In each moment of our lives, we too stand unaware of what God will do in the years to come. And we too do not know what God will make out of us. In times when evil seems to be so powerful, this is what I can believe in. That none of us have any idea what will happen next or what God can transform us into, though we are imperfect. I can believe that Jesus is here despite the cruelty of the world around us, and that he has given to us words to listen to, and that we cannot even imagine the resurrections that lie just beyond the trials that we will face. And on that truth, I place my hope. Amen.